Here's some advice for your friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you've tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone. They got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
Yes, indeed. A whole lot of police cars. That's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges on alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. And before that, the unmistakable growl of Humphrey Bogart, portraying the idealistic newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer, "There's no way, baby, to stop the presses." My name's Tom Robbins, and in homage to that movie, I call this show Deadline NYC. When I first met Jeff Perry, he was working for the United States Post Office in a bulk mail facility in New Jersey. He was an active rank and filer in his union, and he was fired during a wildcat strike in 1978, which I think I wrote about back at the time. And later he won reinstatement, and he ran and won the leadership of his 4,000-member local. And I know he had his hands full because I also reported back then on some of the very serious mobsters who controlled his national union. But somehow, in between fending off both the mob and the bosses and representing his members, Jeff Perry found time to become a most serious student of the history of white supremacy and of black radicalism. Jeff Perry's written and edited several books, including Theodore Allen's The Invention of the White Race, one of the seminal works on white supremacy. Jeff's also just finished the second volume of his biography of Hubert Harrison, who may just be the most important black radical that few Americans have heard about. Jeff's new book from Columbia University Press is titled Hubert Harrison, The Struggle for Equality, 1918 to 1927. Jeff, welcome, and thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Thanks for jogging my memory.
Listen, Jeff, you are indeed a rare bird. You know, you are a true working-class scholar and an independent scholar. You're not affiliated with any academic institution. You went to work at the post office in what? Sorry?
No, I was going to say, I exactly what you're saying. I'm independent. I'm working class. But the two people I write about, Harrison and Allen, were similarly independent and working class, and they both worked for the post. That's just a little anecdote. Go on.
I was gonna mention the fact that Hubert Harrison also worked for the post office and got fired, but I didn't know that Ted Allen also worked there. That's interesting. Well, as well it should be, a place that produces great radical leaders and great radical historians. Well, so how did a rank and file union activist, a labor leader, become a research historian?
I was, while I was working in the post office and for the union, I started to go back to graduate school. I had an undergraduate degree, and I went back to graduate school first in labor studies and then in American history. And I was particularly concerned with the question of my generation, your generation, essentially, why no socialism in the U.S.? Why had left efforts not been proven more successful? And I started examining a lot of the documents from the turn of the 20th century. And I got familiar with most of the organizations and the writings, and I was paying particular attention to the question of white supremacy. And that was in part because as far back as about 1969 or 70, I went to a talk down at a place called Alternate U on 14th Street, where a fellow, where Ted Allen was giving a talk. And he elaborated on how in three previous periods, when laboring and poor people came together in U.S. history, those periods being Reconstruction, Populism, and Depression 30s, the ruling class turned to white supremacy to beat back efforts at social change. So I got to know Allen. I got familiar with his work because he was a brilliant, brilliant writer. And as I said earlier, an autodidact who lived in Brooklyn. You know, he was a former UMW president of three locals, but then he moved up to Brooklyn after he hurt his back in the mines. So I was working on why no socialism in the U.S. under two very fine scholars, a fellow named Nathan Huggins, who unfortunately passed away after he left Columbia and went up to Harvard, and Hollis Lynch, who's from Trinidad Tobago and had written on Blyden and Garvey, who has one of his daughters is up at the Schomburg Center, and the other daughter, he has two very talented daughters. And I was working under them. And in the course of that work, I came across three articles, one by J.A. Rogers in World's Great Men of Color, one by Richard B. Moore in the Encyclopedia of the American Negro or some such. I forget the full title, the accurate title. And one by a chapter in a book by Philip S. Foner. And they all spoke very highly of Hubert Harrison. And I didn't really know very much about him. So I went up to the Schomburg Center. And I, back then, if you could read a book on microfiche or microfilm and maybe print it out and take it home and read it and mark it up. And that's what I did. And after I did that, I was just arrested by the clarity of Harrison's thought. He was, to my mind, the clearest thinking activist radical of the early 20th century, and he understood the centrality of the struggle against white supremacy. Okay. So
I'm talking to Jeff Perry. He's the author of his second volume of the life of Hubert Harrison. It's called The Struggle for Equality, 1918 to 1927. We'll tell people how to get a hold of that in a little bit. But first, Jeff, why don't we check some of the boxes, since most people are not familiar with Hubert Harrison, as to why he was so important.
Okay. Well, Harrison he's known as the father of Harlem radicalism. That's what A. Philip Randolph and others called him. And J.A. Rogers, who I mentioned, calls him the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era. And Richard B. Moore says he's the outstanding internationalist, black internationalist of his era. He was the leading black activist in the Socialist Party around 1912, which was a heyday for the party, when Eugene Debs had a highest percentage of his votes for the presidency. During that period, Harrison spoke as many as 23 times a week for Du Bois. He went down to Wall and Broad Street.
For Du Bois?
No, for Debs. Excuse me, did I say Du Bois? For Debs. Okay. Debs was running for the presidency. Right. And he went down and spoke from 1 o'clock till 4 o'clock when the gong tolled the close of the stock market on socialism in front of the stock exchange. And that article was detailed in New York Times. And I refer to that, and listeners may appreciate this, as the early Occupy Wall Street, because the audience was as far as his voice could reach. Yeah.
The first and Occupy then, Wall Street.
Yeah. Then in 1913, he was with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and Big Bill Haywood at the Patterson strike, and the comments on his very militant talks were all in the Patterson press. And he spoke before as many as 50,000 people in Union Square. He was an outstanding socialist. And he wrote the first major series of articles by a black socialist on the Negro and socialism, which had some very insightful comments, which we can get into later. But
why don't I just stop you for a second, if I can, because obviously his work as a member of the Socialist Party, which was a powerful force, I think, at the time, but he found he had problems there. He felt that there was not enough of an emphasis on the issue of race. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, very much so. And he had put before the party, before the 1912 convention, he said, Southernism or socialism, what's going to be the direction of this party? And there were numerous instances where he felt the party either did not deal with or backed off questions regarding white supremacy and racism. And by 1914, he left the Socialist Party. And when he left, he offered what is probably one of the most important but least heeded criticisms in the history of the left. And that's why it's unfortunate that people didn't know much about his life and his history for so many years after his death. But he said that the white labor movement and the white socialists put the white race first before class at their core. And that's a very profound criticism. And after
But it was quite accurate, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. And after that criticism, he did a few little things in between, but then he turned to concentrated work in the African-American community. It was going to be he was going to be proactive. He wasn't going to wait around, you know.
Let me just ask you, was he disgusted with the socialists, Jeff? Is that why he withdrew and went up to Harlem?
Debs, they wouldn't let they wouldn't root him down south. At the 1912 convention, he had put to the socialist to question Southernism or socialism. They didn't even discuss the Negro question at the 1912 convention. They did issue one statement on Asian immigration, which was very racist and talking about class consciousness being learned, but race consciousness being inborn and, you know, kind of a racism is innate theory. And they didn't support him when he was trying to do a lot of his public speaking and stuff. He had initiated a colored socialist club, which was open to European Americans and African Americans, but they didn't support it. After a few months, they cut back support. So he's very disenchanted.
Hey, he was so far ahead of his time, wasn't he?
Yes, and that just on that point, which very precise what you say, and that is pointed out at his eulogy by Arturo Alfonso Schomburg. Harrison lived; he was very popular.
For whom the Schomburg Center is named after.
Yes. And he delivered the main eulogy at Harrison's funeral. And he said, Hubert Harrison is ahead of his time. And similarly, 70 years later, the historian John Henry Clark did an introduction for Black Classic Press, which is put out by Paul Coates, Ta-Nehisi Coates' dad. And in that introduction, he writes, John Henry Clark writes, "Well, Hubert Harrison is speaking to us again, loud and clear. Let us hope this time we hear and learn from him and take his message forward." Something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing. But he was very much ahead of his times. But he was very popular in his day, too. So it's not like nobody was listening to him. He'd have thousands attend his talks. He'd walk down the streets in Harlem because he lived amongst the people. And the kids would follow him and they'd talk to him. And his Harlem funeral was attended by couple thousand people. I mean, he's very popular. And I have a little quote here later about how within 2 months after his death, all the leading Black publications were kind of ignoring him. But that's another story.
Well, you know, that's the sad and tragic part of it. And really why your work, I think, is nothing short of heroic for having resuscitated both his work, which you've put online, I believe, published, and now this two-volume biography. The show is Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, and I'm talking to Jeffrey Perry, who's the author of a new book, his second volume in his biography of Hubert Harrison, The Struggle for Equality, 1918 to 1927. Jeff, why don't you take a first cut at telling people how they could actually get a break if they wanted to pick up a copy of your book?
Great. Both books. And I'm also going to tell them where they can get lots of free information. The two books of the biography are available from Columbia University Press website. And if you go there and look up either Volume 1, which is Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1917, or Volume 2, Hubert Harrison, The Struggle for Equality, 1918 to 1927. If you go to each one of those books, you can get them at 20% off using a special code CUP20. That stands for Columbia University Press 20. I recommend that people take advantage of that, but I also encourage and urge people to, besides getting the book for themselves if they can, to get it and speak to their public libraries or their college or university libraries and get these books into the libraries where others can read and learn about Harrison. Harrison was a man of the people. He was a great proponent of free public libraries. He would speak regularly at the public libraries. And by getting the books into the libraries, you're playing it forward, kind of. You can pass it on to
That's
others.
A great idea. So That's a great suggestion.
I urge people to do that. And now Okay. Two other things I just want to mention. One, I was able to track down his children who were alive way back in 1981. And on the third meeting, they brought me into the front room of a railroad flat in Harlem on 150th Street, where they had preserved his papers. They may have moved once or twice before then in a closet in this apartment. And on the third visit, they said, take these and do with these what you need to do. And I was overwhelmed. So I became an archivist and everything overnight. I got the Mylar, the acid-free paper. I would work all day and come home and spend hours, you know, organizing, inventorying, transcribing these documents. And they were ultimately placed after both children died. His grandson, Charles Richardson, who unfortunately has also since died, we placed these papers at Columbia University Rare Book and Manuscript Library. The family got a very large sum of money for them, which the family got. I'm not a ripoff at all in any of this. And those papers are there for people to access and see. It's a very large collection. But most importantly, when we placed the papers there, part of the agreement was that they would put some Harrison papers, some key Harrison papers online. And Columbia last year came through. It took a while. But they threw up over 1,300 pages from his papers. And of those 1,300 pages, it's important things like his diary. He kept a diary, extraordinary document. You know, most radical activists don't do that. And it's you know, he recorded things pretty honestly in that diary and with great perception. And I have a nice quote from him about what he tried to do with the diary. But it's also things like when he does book reviews, because he's the first regular black book reviewer in history. And when he does book reviews, I will quote from Harrison's book review. I will link to it online if I can or at the archives. And then I will link to it at HathiTrust or Internet Archives, one of these permanent online sites where you can see the actual book he's reviewing. So, And one last thing about all of this. In this volume two, in the index, in the footnotes, wherever possible, I put links to whatever's being referred to. So you can have right from the book, you can go right to Harrison's articles Harrison's talking about. It's really kind of a 21st century way to put these footnotes
great job.
Together.
Great job, yeah. Jeff. Okay. Well, let's just slow down and try to sort of dig into the story about who Hubert Harrison was, for one thing. I mean, well, one of the things about him that I've gotten from my reading of your work is that he was obviously a guy who didn't hesitate to speak his mind despite his allegiances. You talked before about his voicing his objections in the Socialist Party, but he then went on to briefly work with Marcus Garvey and his organization and broke with him as well. He criticized Booker T. Washington. He criticized W.E.B. Du Bois. Was he a cantankerous sort of fellow? What was he like? You have any sense of his personality?
Yeah, I think he was pretty straight shooting, actually. He, when he came to the U.S. in 1900, one of the early groups he was affiliated with were these. He lived on West 62nd Street, which was the area of concentration for African-Americans and Afro-Caribbeans before the IRT subway gets completed in 1904. And he goes down to 53rd Street. There are Lyceums in two black churches, or two churches that attract the African American population. The main one being the one on 53rd St. Rose. My mind is going mush right now, but St. Benedict the Moor. And at that church, there would be people like Schomburg, like Johnny Bruce, a great journalist, like Charles Burroughs, his wife-to-be, Williana Jones Burroughs, and others. They were working-class black intellectuals. They would come together. They would have discussions, freewheeling discussions and debate. They would, you know, oftentimes disagree, but they could go out later and still be friends. You know, it was a very healthy intellectual atmosphere. And it was also a place where Afro-Caribbeans and African-Americans came together. And that shaped Harrison very much for his later life. And so as he continues on, in that tradition, and he criticizes, as you indicated, he criticizes Booker T in 1910 when Booker T goes to Europe. I'm shorthanding this, and basically says things are fine back home. Du Bois gets together 50 prominent people and says, and they say, no, this is not right. And Harrison writes two letters to the New York Sun, basically saying, Booker T, you're free to say what you want, but you should tell the truth. And Booker T has Harrison summarily removed from the post office. I knew how to get Harrison's postal records because of my years in the post office. He had a totally clean POD-7, what they call. Yeah, and he was fired. And in the Booker T papers, there's some correspondence between Booker T and Emmett Scott, his right-hand man, and says, yeah, we took care of that guy. And the third party.
You nailed that one. That's great.
Yeah, the third
party. We're talking about Booker T. Washington, just for those folks who might be confused. We're not talking about the great Stax musician. We're talking about Booker T. Washington.
And the third party involved in that was the postmaster of New York named Morgan. And to this day, Morgan Station is on West 38th, what, 39th Street. Right. It's the largest postal facility in Manhattan. So he criticizes Booker T. Then when he founds the New Negro Movement in 1917, and this is a real pioneering activity, it's a race-conscious movement for social equality, political equality, enforcement of 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment and lynching. And it's the first organization, and he puts out The Voice, which is the first newspaper of the militant new Negro movement. Now,
that was his name?
1917.
Give us the name of the
new Negro. The Voice. And they referred to it usually as the New Negro Movement, but sometimes Harrison will refer to it also as the Militant New Negro Movement. And that helps to distinguish it from what comes 8 years later when Alain Locke puts out a publication called The New Negro, which is largely a literary publication. And Harrison's publications are militant, they're political, they're also literary because Harrison's an extraordinary literary talent.
Let me just stop you for a second, Jeff. Yeah. Hold on, because I just want to. He was obviously able to affect a lot of people. The quotes that you read from the encomiums that were given at his funeral, but the picture that sort of comes through is that this was a guy who was sort of a voice crying in the wilderness. What made him effective? Was this paper widely read that he put out? Was he able to actually impact the day-to-day activities of black radicals, do you think?
Yes, I do. But one of the key things, and this is another, and this is why when I wrote these books, particularly the second book, this is a very large book, and I lay out what he's up against all the time. And a key thing to look at, you have to follow the money and see where is Booker T. Washington getting his support from so that he can have a public presence. Where is Du Bois getting his?
You're saying this was something that Hubert Harrison did, was that he followed the money to try to analyze who was funding.
Yeah, well, this is something that Harrison, in effect, didn't do, because Garvey's getting lots of money in a certain way, Du Bois is getting money in a certain way, Booker T. did. But Harrison tried to, you know, maintain his independence. He was offered $10,000 by a white supporter in 1917 for his voice, and he reportedly refused it. And that was a large sum of money back then. So he tried to maintain his independence, but it reached a circulation when it first came out of about 11,000, which was fairly significant, you know, in those early years. And his talks, his talks would draw a large crowd. So he had, and then he would, as his life went on, when he becomes editor of the Negro World, that paper sweeps the globe. He becomes managing editor and takes control of it. And that paper is the most widely read black paper in the world and in the country. And he's getting his word out in many respects there when he's doing that. And when he speaks, he draws large crowds oftentimes, but he has no long-lasting organizational ties or anything like that.
He was a free operator. He was not associated, but he did work. Let's just talk briefly before we take a short musical break about Marcus Garvey, with whom Harrison was associated, and then he became pretty dramatically disassociated. One of Garvey's rivals was assassinated at one point. A. Philip Randolph received a terrifying package. This was sort of a chapter of history that people don't really know too much about, and Harrison was in the middle of it, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, and people who get to read this book will find out many interesting things about Garvey that I don't think they knew beforehand. But Harrison, when he founds the Liberty League, Marcus Garvey actually joins Hubert Harrison's Liberty League. Those familiar with Marcus Garvey know he's not one to usually join anyone else's organization. And he's with Harrison for a while, but then he goes off on his own road, and he's trying to raise money to do what he wants to do. And he's struggling for a couple of years, as did Harrison, you know, to continue surviving. And then in late 1919, after an assassination attempt on Garvey in October, his organization starts to take off a bit, and he approaches Harrison and asks Harrison if Harrison would like to lead a school Garvey was preparing or planning to set up in Africa.
Well, just give us the background here for a second. Hold on one second. At this point, Marcus Garvey was an amazing figure in terms of leading the struggle for black liberation at that point in the country. That's how he was perceived, right?
Well, not quite yet. It's coming. It's coming. 1919, he was still struggling. You know, he was still struggling. By 1920, he's really riding the crest, and he's attracting lots of attention. But in 1919, he's still struggling, but he's following a program which Harrison explains is basically what Harrison had put out in the Liberty League, you know, racial consciousness, racial solidarity, things like that. And Garvey was running with that. But Garvey then, when he has Harrison come over to his office, and when Harrison goes there, he instead asked Harrison to become editor of the Negro World, his newspaper. And so when Harrison accepts that, because it would have been difficult for Harrison to go to Africa anyway, because being born in the Virgin Islands, which was Danish West Indies when Harrison was born, his whole citizenship question was still not clear. It was said that black Virgin Islanders were citizens in but not of the of the U.S., and he didn't get citizenship papers until 1922. So Garvey asked Harrison to edit the Negro World. And Harrison documents in his diary the changes he made to that paper. And it's one of the striking and important chapters in black journalism. People would want to read this. And so he's in charge of
the paper. What were some of those changes, Jeff?
Well, he's changing how the headlines, he's changing. People have to identify themselves as authors. He's talking about, he brings in columns like Poetry for the People, West Indian News Notes, book review sections, just a host of things.
So he was really making
it
into a wide audience interest publication.
Yes. And so he does that, and the paper really takes off. The paper really takes off, and it goes internationally, too. But Harrison winds up, by the end of 1920, he's disenchanted with Garvey, which he documents his reasons why, again, in his diary, and he'll document them again later. But he stays on writing as a contributing editor until the end of 1922, but he's not managing editor any longer. So, and amongst his differences with Garvey, well, there are many, and I don't want to spill all the beans, but he basically doesn't think Garvey's playing straight up with the money that's coming in terms of the Liberian construction loan, the Black Star ship line. He doesn't like Garvey. He doesn't think Garvey works well with others, you know, those around him. He doesn't utilize their talents.
We'll come back to Garvey and his relationship in a second. It's 5:30.
Sure.
I'm Tom Robbins. The show is Deadline NYC, and we're talking to Jeffrey Perry, working class scholar and researcher who has just published his new book, Hubert Harrison: The Struggle for Equality, 1918 to 1927. You just mentioned how Harrison put book reviews, started putting culture into that. He was, as I understand from your book, he became friends with many of the figures in Harlem and New York over the time. And one of them was a poet and composer whose name was Andy Razaf, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, R-A-Z-A-F, who went on to write some of the greatest songs of his era, Honeysuckle Rose, Ain't Misbehaving, Stopping at the Savoy. And he also wrote one of the most searing songs I think ever recorded about the price of racism, called What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue? So we're going to play Ubi Blake, another friend of Harrison's. He's here on the piano with a woman named Edith Wilson, who recorded it back at the time, and this is their recording from many years later. Reggie, you want to cue up this tune for us? Thank you.
What did I do to be so black and blue? No choice for me, no company, even the mouse ran from my house. All my life through, I've been so black and blue. Just like a thorn, I'm so forlorn. Why was I born? What did I do to be so black and blue?
Well, I called it one of the most searing songs ever. You know, UB Blake was still around back in our day, Jeff. He was playing at the Cookery on 8th Street back for a while. I went to hear him a few times. It's so marvelous.
Yeah, I went and saw Alberta Hunter, another one.
Yes, exactly. Same place. Cooker. Right.
Yeah.
So why don't we just talk for a moment about that break from the politics I had asked you when we talked earlier last week about how he viewed the Harlem Renaissance, which he was in the middle of, and he had an interesting perspective on it. Tell us about that.
Sure. Thanks, Tom. Harrison, in 1926, he wrote an article, I think it was in the Pittsburgh Courier, but it's in volume two, No Literary Renaissance. And in it, he raised questions, again, of who the so-called what he referred to as the so-called new literary renaissance writers were, where they were getting their funding and their support, who they were writing for. And he made the argument that a renaissance is a rebirth. And he thought that if these younger writers knew their history a little better, they would realize that there was a continuous flow from, often ignored, from black writers and authors and poets. And so he didn't jump into this whole new Negro literary renaissance bandwagon. He was particularly critical of the quote, Nigger Heaven book, which came out by one of the people who supported a lot of these artists. And things like that. So he raised questions about it, serious questions.
All right. Well, we're going to try to avoid that word if we can on the air.
I have it in quotes, and that was the title of the book.
Right.
So, Carl Van Vechten,
well, there was another thing that Harrison emphasized throughout his career. And by the way, people should know that he died tragically young at the age. He was 44, right?
Yes. And he died
of appendicitis. Is that what he died?
Appendicitis-related condition, and he's doing better. And then he reportedly took a turn for the worse and died. Just parenthetically, people might want to know his grandson, Ray Richardson, was a TV producer for a show called Say Brother up in Boston. He was our age. He died under very mysterious circumstances in 1971. And I did an article for Black Agenda Report and Black Star News about his death under suspicious circumstances, which people may want to look for online.
Well, that's intriguing and troubling. The thing I was going to bring up, Jeff, was about Harrison's very adamant and very clear-cut statements, I think going back in during the time even of World War I, about the need for black people to arm themselves for self-defense. And I think it was after the bloody riots on black people in East St. Louis and the Tulsa pogrom that resulted in hundreds of deaths. Using the language of the time, and the quote you have in your book is, white men lynch Negroes because Negro lives are cheap, end quote. And what black people needed to do was to make sure that whites paid a price when they attacked blacks. Was that a pretty astonishing thing to say at the time for a black person?
Yeah, it was very, very militant. And he said that, and just, again, to bring a little tie to more contemporary things, when Harrison spoke on East St. Louis, it was at a big rally in Harlem, a large rally, and that East St. Louis is only 15 or 20 miles from Ferguson, where there were large rallies, you know, much more recently, and so there's a little connection there that people might find of interest. And on, you know, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he also went out in New Jersey when the Klan started growing in the north and burned a cross on Garrett Mountain. He came out there and challenged the Klan. He was very militant on this.
Well, when you say he challenged the Klan, didn't he actually have a debate?
Yeah. Well, he was speaking he was an invited guest at Patterson and at a site in Patterson. And some Klans people came up and raised some questions, and he answered them and apparently put them down pretty decisively. But then he also challenged them, come back and have a big debate. And the person who was there said, well, I'm not qualified to debate. But Harrison just had it all over any of the Klans people there. But he also went out in 1924. He went out to the Midwest because the Klan was rising in the Midwest and starting to get a lot of votes. And he campaigned pretty vigorously against the Klan and against, you know, trying to mobilize people to get black voters to be a decisive element in, you know, beating back reaction, so to speak, in the Midwest. He traveled. The furthest he ever traveled in his life was out to Chicago and up to Boston and down to Virginia. Other than going, you know, being from St. Croix.
You know, it's funny. I mean, your description of his confronting the Klan in Patterson and challenging them to the debate seems almost astonishingly quaint and polite. And yet, obviously, we know that there was nothing polite about the Klan at the time and that they quite regularly lynched people like Hubert Harrison.
Yes.
What was it about him, do you think, that made him so fearless that he would go out to the Midwest and say, all right, I'm going to help people challenge the Klan? That wasn't something that other organizations were doing at the time, was it?
No. And for the most part, no, he had a great deal of courage. He was ready to back what he thought, you know, with his body. Just even on a more personal level, I think I mentioned to you the other day, sometimes he'd be speaking on street corners in New York, and there was one incident up on 178th Street in Manhattan when he got attacked by a mob of you know, rowdies, and he had to take the table leg where he was speaking and use it to defend himself physically. And, of course, he was the one who got arrested, and the other guys, I don't think, got arrested at all. But he would face this at times. He had a lot of courage, a lot of fortitude, and he kept pushing. He was focused on the centrality of opposition to white supremacy, struggle for equality, and he thought this was the key to radical social change, because he thought in the U.S., essentially he thought that it was white supremacy which upheld the system of capitalism here. That's what the ruling class relied upon. And in order to beat them back, we had to take them on that issue. And so he saw that as the key kind of to struggles. And well, even when he's later on. Yeah, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, let me ask you this. I mean, part of the premise of Marcus Garvey's movement was that black people needed their own state, their own country, advocated moving back to Africa in some ways. Was Harrison for the separation of blacks and whites in America, or was he an integrationist? How did he deal with that issue, which was so front and center in black radicalism at the time?
Okay, first, Garvey advocated go back to Africa, right? And I don't think he ever advocated a separate state in the U.S. He was going to go back to Africa. And according to his objects and aims, it was to civilization, to bring civilization to Africans. And Harrison was critical of the notion of civilizing Africans. He thought we should learn from Africans rather than bring things. Garvey's idea was rejected even by the Liberians when he sent some people over there to investigate what conditions were like. But he was talking about going back to Africa. And Harrison, in contrast, in 1924, when he sets up his last organization, it's the International Colored Unity League, he talks about setting up a state or states for Negro, quote, Negro people. But they're not going to be exclusively, you know, other people could live there, too. But he wanted states where perhaps Negroes could go to and concentrate their forces and their energies and chart their own course a little bit better. So he was willing to even explore that. What's interesting about that is that's about 3 years before the U.S. Communist Party comes out and puts out a call for a Negro nation in the South. As a matter of fact, when Claude McKay, a friend of Harrison's, goes to the Soviet Union in 1922, I believe it is. They ask him over there to write a book on the, quote, Negroes in America, and they give him Hubert Harrison's book. In the Soviet Union, they give him Hubert Harrison's book as a basis for doing some of his writings. And McKay does write a work, but it doesn't get published into English, I think, until the late 50s, early 60s.
Was Harrison ever close to the United U.S. Communist Party?
Yes, he was. Harrison worked with everybody. That's why, you know, sometimes the notion is that he wouldn't work with people. He worked with basically everybody. He was the head of one of their front organizations, American Negro Labor Committee, in 1925. He was working with them up until a strike in Harlem, at a theater in Harlem, in which he disagreed with them over their stand on the strike. He thought the Communist Party was taking a position which was sacrificing the black workers at the expense of the white workers, so he parted ways. But even as early as 1921, after he had made one of his breaks from the communists, there were meetings called downtown in the Village. Claude McKay, Cyril Briggs, Rose Pastor Stokes, who was a European-American communist, prominent. And the meetings were to talk about getting a contingent in the African-American community to work in distinct from and in opposition to Garvey. And it was said that money was offered to Harrison to lead that effort. But he, according to the accounts, refused to do that because he didn't want to be anyone's stalking horse against Garvey. You know, he wasn't, you know, up cheaply for sale or anything like that.
He was a very principled man, wasn't he?
Well, in general, yeah, but he's not perfect, and I mentioned that in the beginning, too. And,
well, none of us are. That's okay. But what you just described is a pretty principled act.
Yeah.
This is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show is called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking to writer and organizer, activist Jeffrey Perry, whose second volume biography of Hubert Harrison, The Struggle for Equality, 1918 to 1927, has just been printed by Columbia University. Jeff, tell us one more time about just that address that people can access if they want to get your book and get a discount from it.
Good. The address is Columbia University Press online. You can go to it and use the code CUP20. That stands for Columbia University Press 20. And the two volumes are Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918, and Hubert Harrison, The Struggle for Equality, 1918 to 1927. Let me point out to the listeners that I believe this two-volume biography is the first full-length multi-volume biography of an Afro-Caribbean and only the fourth of an African-American after those of Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Langston Hughes. Harrison is a giant of Black history, radical history, U.S. history, Caribbean history, Afro-Caribbean history. I encourage people to get these books if they can, but again, contact their public libraries, to contact their reference desk or acquisitions, and ask them to get these books in their library so others can read about Harrison.
Jeff, let me ask you a question. Your interest in both originally the works of Theodore Allen, who in turn helped lead you to the works of Hubert Harrison, and now you've spent so many years rooting into his life and making it available for the first time to so many people. That all came out of your own beliefs about the role of racism in America. Did your own thinking change during the time you explored Harrison's and other lives while you were putting together these works?
I think it deepened. I mean, Allen, you know, I got to know Allen very well, and he left me his papers just as I was left by the Harrison family. I was given Harrison's papers. So I placed Allen's papers up at UMass Amherst alongside Du Bois's papers. They're up there now, as are part of my postal papers, but not all. There's been a big struggle over that, you know, with the that old union that you talked about. And Harrison's papers are at Columbia. But the two key things I sensed in Harrison and Allen in the very beginning, which were consistent with what I had thought, was they challenged the two main ideological props of white supremacy: the idea that racism is innate and the idea that white workers, in quotes, white workers, benefit from race prejudice. They challenged that, and that stayed with me. Also, what just developed and deepened was what I found in Harrison, but I also had, it was also there in Allen. Harrison understood white supremacy to be central to capitalist rule in the U.S., how they maintain control. He emphasized that those desiring significant social change would have to struggle against it to succeed. He emphasized that Black people should develop race consciousness as both a measure of self-defense and is a key strategic component in that struggle. He understood, this is Harrison, that African Americans are the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. A touchstone is a wonderful metaphor. Touchstone is a black stone. You take the metal and you rub it against the touchstone to see if it's really the gold it purports to be. It's a wonderful metaphor we can use in our social practice. Any issue you look at, housing, unemployment, education, workplace discipline, etc. Let's put it to the touchstone, see how Black people are faring, and say, well, okay, how are we going to address this? Harrison also understood that while the color line exists, the cant of democracy, the chant, is intended as dust in the eyes of white voters and it was used in wartime to mask sordid imperialist aims. Because if your readers recollect, Woodrow Wilson led the U.S. into World War I to make the world safe for democracy. That was his slogan. And whereas he had been opposed to the war shortly before making that statement, and Harrison didn't believe him one bit because he knew Wilson's record both previously and at the time. And he had a big founding meeting of his Liberty League in which he said, let us make the South safe for democracy. And at that founding meeting, Harrison was there. Adam Clayton Powell Sr. was there. Garvey gets invited up to the stage to speak. Harrison was clear. He said he didn't believe, and he says this several places, that he didn't believe Wilson's protestations about democracy. And Harrison thought that true democracy and equality for African Americans implies a revolution startling to even think of. Not the sham democracy, but real true democracy and equality, because when you get that, you're hitting at how they maintain control. So they were some of the key things that, and these just developed as I came to know Harrison better. Children told me, one last thing, his children told me when they gave me his papers to preserve and work with, they said, remember, Jeff, he was always opposed to white supremacy, and that, I found that out to be the case. You know, he was very clear on that.
As are also, you, and as you have been.
Say, he also left the door open. You know, if some of these, quote, white radicals show their sincerity and take up the cause and challenge it amongst the European Americans and stuff, we're more than willing to work together. But, you know, he wasn't finding that the case very often.
Well, let me just ask you this: in terms of all the years that you spent working on Hubert Harrison's life, excavating his works and interpreting it, digging into his diaries, as a white guy, I mean, we're two white guys tonight talking about one of the seminal black radicals of our time. Did you ever have any concerns about, well, gee, you know, am I able as a white person to be able to interpret the work that I'm looking at, to be able to interpret his life? Did that ever trouble you, or did you ever question your ability to do that?
Well, I wouldn't phrase it quite like that, because as I said, I've been deeply influenced by Ted Allen, and if people get to read his works, which I recommend, the ones which I edited, he says in the beginning of Volume 1 of The Invention of the White Race, it took me a long time to say, but I've learned to say that I am not white. And Allen himself rejected being called white. He said, look, I'm human, and if you care to call me something, call me European-American. And he worked tirelessly to challenge the white race, white identity, and things like that. And I have tried to do that myself. So that's on one hand a partial answer to your question. But the other thing that I do in these books, and readers will see this, is I make it a point to let Harrison speak wherever I can. The book is so rigorously footnoted. It's over 200 pages of footnotes.
We're gonna have to leave it there, Jeff. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. But I just want to one more time say that Jeff Perry is who we've been talking to. The show is Deadline NYC. I'm Tom Robbins. But his book, Hubert Harrison, The Struggle for Equality, 1918 to 1927, is an incredibly impressive and illuminating work, and I urge people to take Jeff up on his offer to hit up that site and get your 20% off. It's really a good read. Jeff, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Likewise, I really appreciate sharing your show.
Okay, very great. We'll let Oliver Nelson steal the last few moments. Thank you, Reggie Johnson. Have a good night, everybody. Stay warm.
Chick Corea with Bobby McFerrin on an album entitled Rendezvous in New York. And in this time of COVID here in New York, most New Yorkers are wearing face masks. But then there's the guy on the street corner smoking a cigarette, not wearing a mask. The woman talking on her cell phone who thinks the person on the other end won't hear unless she pulls her mask off. And what about that couple who walk by? A woman's mask is below her mouth and the guy's mask is below his nose. Well, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has now recommended that we wear two face masks because of variant strains of the virus. And for masks to fit snugly, a cotton mask on top of a surgical mask may offer 95% protection from exposure to aerosols and tiny particles that could contain the coronavirus. Well, WBAI has 100% cotton masks for you with our logo and the saying, "Keep Free Speech Radio Alive." We have these for you. You can wear these over other masks for better protection. They are washable and come in white or black. Please call 516-620-3602 to order your cotton face mask for a tax-deductible contribution of $35 or buy two masks for $70. You can also go to our donation site. Go to give2wbai.org to order your WBAI face masks. Again, the phone number is 516-620-3602. You'll be helping to keep Free Speech Radio alive here on WBAI in New York.
That's right, a little bit more of Armando's Rumba here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.